If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
They say if you build your retail at the sidewalk, you can build more residential floor area on top of the building. So it's kind of like spend some money on flood-resistant glass and we'll give you another, you say, say the flood-resistant glass is $2 or $3 million. Well, we'll give you the equivalent of $8 or $10 million of more retail residential space to make it worth your while to make the streets work. And that's why I'm saying the New York City zoning, especially here, is really clever. But I mean, we must have had two teams of lawyers and a zoning specialist and have to go back to the city about 3 or 4 times before anybody actually understood what the text that they had written meant and how that worked with the building code. So it's like it's clever, but it's hard to navigate.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Chris Fogarty, co-founding partner at Fogarty Finger in New York, also with offices in Atlanta and Boston. Chris oversees the concept and design development of all firm architecture projects. After studying architecture at University College's Bartlett in London, he received a master's in architecture from the University of Edinburgh. Prior to founding Fogarty Finger in 2003, Chris was a senior designer at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, SOM to the rest of us, in the London, Washington, D.C., and New York offices, playing a significant role in national and international competitions and in designing award-winning office and mixed-use buildings. The project we're chatting about today is Nevin's Landing in Gowanus, Brooklyn, New York, which is a neighbor to the Powerhouse Arts building that we did an interview about in 2024. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Poised along the Gowanus Canal, Nevin's Landing redefines Brooklyn's post-industrial waterfront through a lens of architectural continuity and urban resilience. Designed by Fogarty Finger for Charney Companies and Tavros Capital, the 600,000-square-foot development occupies a pivotal site between two canal bridges, an infrastructural seam that has long marked the district's evolution from manufacturing corridor to mixed-use neighborhood.
You know, we do lots of different things at my office, and housing is a big part of that. It's hard to talk about housing in New York City and not really talk about the shortage of housing in New York City. It's a deeply, deep, huge issue. I mean, just to give you a sense, the average wage you might need to pay rent and not be rent burdened in New York City is about $135,000. So the rents are incredibly high. There's an incredible shortage. I think vacancies sit around 1% or under. There's just nowhere for people to live at any level, at the poor, medium. I mean, I guess the super rich are fine. They can sort themselves out. But the, you know, for the average person, your rent is taking up almost half your salary or a third of your salary. So it's a big problem. The obvious answer is to build more, and that's easy to say and as hard to do. New York is pretty built up. You know, I mean, anybody who's seen photos of it, we've got skyscrapers everywhere. So there's not much space left. And there are some pockets, though, and those pockets are the old service areas that used to kind of have light manufacturing or storage or stuff that would supply the population centers of Manhattan or downtown Brooklyn. And those kind of still exist. They're kind of zoned as these manufacturing districts. And zoning is really hard to change in New York City. And so you have these sort of pockets, sometimes 10, 20 acres of land that sit, you know, in the shadow of the downtowns of New York City. And Gowanus is one of those. It's this large parcel of land. It sits just south of Brooklyn downtown, and it's surrounded on three sides by perhaps the most beautiful historic landmark districts in New York City. It's got Park Slope to the east, Carroll Gardens and Cobble Hill to the north and to the west. So you're surrounded by these beautiful neighborhoods. And then you've got this one-story sort of underdeveloped area sitting in the middle of all of that. And it's not just undeveloped because of the zoning, it's all undeveloped because running through the middle of it is this canal. So it should be even more beautiful, right? You've got a canal, you've got all this potential, except that canal is so heavily polluted. It was the busiest canal in the US for almost 100 years, supplying all the oil and gas and coal to go off and supply Brooklyn and Manhattan. And it is absolutely polluted. The bottom of the canal is like this black sludge, and they call it black mayonnaise, and it's just disgusting and stinks. And so about 15, 16 years ago, a group of concerned neighbors, Gowanus Conservancy, got together, and they took with the EPA, kind of got the canal designated as a superfund, and that allowed them to get the money to start cleaning it up. And so between finding the companies that had caused that shell, you know, all these big corporations that had caused this pollution, and New York City, actually, they raised about $2 billion to spend cleaning up the canal and dealing with other things. And it's been a great success. So they're dredging out that black mayonnaise, cleaning it off. And then they actually go and put a concrete cap at the bottom of the canal and kind of seal in anything else at the bottom. So it's a big success, and wildlife is returning. But what they couldn't do, what the Conservancy couldn't do, was deal with all the polluted acres and acres of land that's next to the canal. And so they worked with the city. And so you've got this kind of interesting thing. You've got this Nature Conservancy working with the city to upzone and change the zoning of a district. And the logic was that they would be able to get the developers, if they upzone the areas to housing, they would be able to get developers interested enough that they would come and take the soil away, remediate the soil and encapsulate it. And that way they could actually take on all the acreage around this canal. And so that's what the city did. They rezoned the district. It took about 10 years to get it rezoned. That's how long these things take. And, you know, they, very clever zoning. What happens in these districts is, because people can't live in them, over the years, artists have moved in, or, you know, rock climbing or various different sort of entertainment venues have kind of taken over these industrial buildings. They've been kind of good use for that. So always worrying when you're rezoning, who do you get rid of, which makes the community so attractive in the first place. So part of the zoning gives bonuses if you recreate artist spaces and you recreate light manufacturing spaces too. So you have these kind of free things all happening together with commercial and retail and everything else. So it's kind of a clever zoning. And our site sits, you know, right in the middle of this new district that's being created. So that's the context in which we were thinking about this project and how it came to be about.
The project's architectural response is both contextual and forward-looking, engaging with Gowanus's industrial vernacular while introducing a refined, contemporary language that supports density, sustainability, and community life.
So the site's about 2.5 acres in size. It's a large rectangular site. It's about 200 feet by 500 feet long. One of the long lengths of it goes along the Gowanus Canal, and the two shorter lengths are two of the main streets that go east-west across Gowanus. And there's three bridges, I think, that go over the canal, and the two streets either side of our building have bridges on them. So those are the most trafficked streets in the neighborhood. And, you know, New York zoning is a pretty blunt force instrument. They kind of tell you what they're expecting to see on that site. And it was very clear from the start that they wanted two separate buildings. The block is, you know, it's this long rectangular site. Actually, we continue a street that used to stop at the one end of our site. And we continue that through to the canal. So we're kind of reconnecting the street grid there. And that sits between these two towers. But the other interesting thing is, you know, New York, there's no review panels or any sort of review of what we do. As long as we meet the zoning setback at the right points, and it could be any color, any style, or anything you like. So it's really up to the architect. And so New York, more than most places, I think they reflect the quality of the architects. And, you know, I'd like to think we're a good firm, but you're as good as your client. And we had amazing clients on this project, the Charney Companies and Tavros, and they were deeply invested in doing something really special here. But because it's so big, it's about 670 apartments split into two buildings, and so about 330 in each or something. And about a quarter of those are affordable units. So those are units that are set aside for lower income that people enter a lottery to be able to get. So this is kind of an interesting part of the way that Gowanus has been thought about. I think that in total, there'll be about 8,500 units built in the district. And that should end up creating about 700, I think, affordable apartments, if I get my math right, is that right? Or 1,200 affordable apartments. So I can't do the math. But anyway, it's not just middle income housing. It's not just market rate housing. It's also affordable housing too. So anyway, we won the competition. And I think there was a small competition, maybe 5 or 6 firms, and we won that competition. And I think what the reason we won is that from the very start, we had this idea that the two buildings would be similar but different. You know, when you've got 500 feet of street frontage, that can become very monotonous if it's all the same. But we wanted the buildings to share all the same details. So the same window details, the same way things happen at the parapets or at the ground or the lobbies, but also to be as different as you could within that framework. So different colors for the building, different setbacks, different heights at the base, different ways of dealing with the same issue, but using the same kit of parts. And so it feels very unified, but it feels very different. And then at the ground floor, it's really interesting. So there's retail at the ground floor, but we also had this mixed-use zoning to incentivize us to put artist space in. And so at the ground floor, instead of doing just big retail, because you imagine these buildings have a huge ground floor, instead of doing just big retail boxes, we have courtyards in the middle of these big block buildings. These courtyards let light all the way down to the ground floor. And we connect, parallel to canal, a separate series of arcades that run through the building and connect from the streets to the courtyards and then to the next building and then back to the next street. And they also, at the courtyards, they spin off these arcades and go off to the waterfront as well. And so it's this kind of all open retail artist space gallery thing. And if it works, it's going to be really amazing. And there's a few places like that we have in New York. Chelsea Market's one. And then we were very inspired by Brentwood Country Mart in LA, which is a really old outdoor market. And then, you know, there's Industry City here as well. And we also Pont City Lofts in Atlanta, which we worked on years ago. And all of these are very successful spaces where retail and public uses, live bands, farmers markets, coffee shops, artists making sculptures, making sculpture. There's a gallery space on the second floor. There's all sorts of things kind of happening here. So I think that's going to be the measure of success for this project. If we can actually create something that works for the community and draws people to this neighborhood, it will have been a real success.
Part of this unified design language is calling back to the industrial New York waterfront that's instantly recognizable to the area's past, including barge-like platforms that float on the landscape.
Our firm we try and do projects that are deeply contextual to many things, neighborhood, history, community, and sometimes the larger context of what we're sitting in. And, you know, New York has this great history of these old warehouses that sit along the waterfronts, the East River or the Gowanus Canal or Hudson River. And there's these beautiful 19th century red brick buildings that are just, there's a few of them left. And there's one down in Red Hook, which is just the other end of the canal. And it has these beautiful arched windows with these lovely metal shutters that some of them are open, some of them are shut. And you get this kind of incredible rhythm of the facade of that building, which is sort of completely irregular and completely regular. So we kind of took that language and on the base of the building for the 5-6 floors of the ground floor, we kind of recreated that in brick and metal. So that sort of just somehow intuitively just pulls you in and makes you think that this is something about New York City waterfronts. It's kind of, it's primal to a New Yorker. They see that, like Dumbo Empire Stores has the same thing going on further up the river. So that was kind of the big thing. And then these towers that sit on top are a kind of lighter grid. But that, again, was sort of thinking a little bit about some of the Art Deco loft buildings that we have in some of these industrial areas as well. So, you know, I don't think it's not a historic building in any sense, or that the pair of buildings, but it talks to history and it talks to people's memories of history. And so I think that was kind of exciting. And then a kind of interesting thing that we had to, which wasn't actually us, which our landscape designer, who's James Corner from Field Operations, another fellow Brit. He had this lovely idea. They had to kind of soften along the bulkhead because we're raising our site up higher than the floodplain. We're also raising it up higher than the canal bulkhead. So we have this kind of spongy, resilient sort of landscape of reeds and plants that can survive floods. And you obviously can't walk through that. So what they had was this beautiful idea of these platforms, wood platforms, that are kind of like the size of the old barges that used to go up and down the canal. And it's like a series of platforms are echoing the idea of these barges tied up along the side of the bulkhead. But they're actually on the land, and they float above this sort of green landscape. So you're kind of walking through these barges, like these platforms with plants underneath you and around you and between you and the water. And, you know, if it floods, you'll just be kind of be like if you're on a barge, you'll be surrounded by water, but you'll be above it. So anyway, that was a kind of beautiful idea. So there's a lot of things going on there.
New York City's updated zoning and permitting processes reflect Gowanus's evolution, enabling mixed-use development within the transforming neighborhood.
New York City, like most cities, has become more thoughtful in its zoning over the years. You know, they were all doing towers in parks in the city 60s and realized that wasn't a great success, and they're much more contextual. So they're thoughtful. They spend a lot of time thinking about this, a lot of outreach to architects and various committees that advise them. So it's not done in a vacuum, but it is just legal text in a big doc, in a big book, no pictures, no diagrams. You're just text, and you've got to analyze that text and understand what it means for your site. And so, you know, navigating zoning text is tricky. You have to have a brain of a lawyer, but the ability of an architect to translate that into something that's beautiful and not just banal. So yes, the zoning, I don't think particularly tricky. James with the landscape had a slightly more detailed review process there because this is all part of a new New York City park, all this waterfront park that's being built along both sides of the canal. There's a whole slew of standards that the cities produce to make sure that it's unified. And so not necessarily the design, but all the lighting or the details of the bollards or the balustrades stop you falling in and everything else all has to be the same thing. And all has to be the same thing because some sites are coming, are being done now, and some sites might be done in 15 years. So that continuity of design has to carry on all the way through. So his team was under a much more detailed review than ours. We just have to meet building code and meet the zoning. And, you know, there's a little bit in there about making sure we have transparency at street front, you know, like can't make our lobbies too big, but there's no one checking it to say, that's just the ugliest thing I've ever seen. No one's doing that. No public review process, no community boards checking in and talking about it. Everybody just, you do all your, that's why this rezoning takes so long, because everybody's trying to protect for the future, because once it's rezoned, the genie's out of the bottle and no one has a review over it again. I mean, there are some areas, if you're in a landmark district, obviously the Landmark Commission then reviews your projects, but everything else, no.
The buildings are strategically elevated above the floodplain, while new streetscapes, walkways, and pocket parks mediate between private development and public realm. These interventions transform once inhospitable terrain into a porous, accessible urban edge where ecology and architecture coexist.
So I think we talked about how the soil has to be cleaned up, removed, taken away, encapsulated. You know, no one wants to live in that. I mean, like, it's kind of like you can't possibly put housing where there's any risk to the people living there. So there's a huge amount of work that goes on before we even start seeing anything come out of the ground. But the biggest problem really with the site is flooding. I think I touched on that earlier. Gowanus was marshland back in the 1800s. It's always been boggy and wet. It's been prone to some flooding, but it's getting more and more so. And what happens is it's not sea level coming up and tides coming up and pushing over the canal. It's normally heavy rain events, storm events that just overwhelm the sewers and flood up into the streets and then flood into the canal and become part of the canal. And the real problem with Gowanus has been that when it floods, it floods into the main raw sewage system too. So the streets and canals and people's basements are just full of what they just had for lunch, effectively. I mean, it's disgusting. So part of that $2 billion cleanup was how do they deal with flooding and everything else? And so there's going to be two 12 million gallon tanks that are being built, one's being just north to us, that are going to, in when it rains, all that sewage is going to be stored in there until the water levels go back down and it can be discharged through the sewage system properly. So that's a huge exercise. Annabelle Seldorf is actually doing a park on top of one of these huge tanks. And then there's another park happening on top of the other ones. That's all connected by this waterfront park that I was talking earlier. So you can kind of tell that's why I say our project's just a small piece of a much bigger project, which is kind of how do you create livable cities which have issues with flood or pollution, all these other things that we face in all our cities, right? So it's actually really clever. For us, the flood means, you know, our streets around us are maybe 6 feet below the flood level, plane level. So we have to build our buildings at least a foot above the floodplain, or all the residential parts of the building. So the law and the code says you can't have any residential uses, including getting into the elevators, below that flood level, or a foot below that flood level. So I think we raised it up another foot. So I think we have to get up something like 6 to 7 feet from the sidewalk to our building elevators and lobby. And you imagine looking at a 7-foot wall of steps is the most miserable entrance you could imagine. So a lot of thought went into how to kind of mitigate that. And the way we've done it is we break it into 2 3-foot sections or 3.5-foot sections. So outside we have 3.5 feet change in level with steps and some ramps, obviously for ADA. And then when you get inside, you kind of then go in a glass door and there's a lower piece that's still in the floodplain. And then you go, but it's inside and the water, if it floods, would go back outside the building when it comes down. But then you go inside and then there's another 3.5 feet of steps and more ramps. And then finally you get to the elevators. So, you know, doing that beautifully, it's hard to even say it, but doing it, designing it beautifully is not easy. So that's part of it. Then you have the fact that you want the storefronts and the retail and the coffee shops, you don't want those 5 or 6 feet up in the air from the sidewalk. So now you've got to bring those back down to the sidewalk, but now they're going to flood. So what you can do is we have flood resistant glass that's able to take the pressure of 5 or 6 feet of water up against it and has a metal storefront mullion system that's able to take that weight of water and stop the water going into the retail. So there's just this incredible, it's ridiculously expensive, of course, but this incredible kind of sort of series of tools that you're, but why would you pay that? Why would the contractors do it? Well, this is where the zoning is kind of interesting. They say if you build your retail at the sidewalk, you can build more residential floor area on top of the building. So it's kind of like spend some money on flood-resistant glass and we'll give you another, you say it's say the flood-resistant glass is $2 or $3 million. Well, we'll give you the equivalent of $8 or $10 million of more retail residential space to make it worth your while to make the streets work. And that's why I'm saying the New York City zoning, especially here, is really clever. But I mean, we must have had two teams of lawyers and a zoning specialist and have to go back to the city about 3 or 4 times before anybody actually understood what the text that they had written meant and how that worked with the building code. So it's like it's clever, but it's hard to navigate.
The North Tower, clad in deep red brick, glass fiber reinforced concrete, and metal panels, pays homage to the district's rugged heritage, while the South Tower, with its refined gray palette, lends a contemporary balance to the composition.
I kind of mentioned the windows at the base and masonry brick, and then, but actually at the ground where it meets the ground and comes to the streets and the canal and everything else, we have these huge precast arches that are 15 feet high and about 30 feet wide or 25 feet wide. And they have these storefronts within them, or they have the entries to the arcades or the entries to the buildings. And they're kind of just this kind of massive kind of warehouse scale. And then you have this smaller grid that's more masonry above that. And then it lightens up to this metal panel and glass grid that as it comes to the top. And then, you know, the other piece of these buildings is that there isn't really a right angle in them in terms of plan. They're every corner is radiused at the outside edges. So they're very soft. It sounds like, as I describe it, it sounds like a hot mess, you know, but it actually somehow all pulls together in some sort of, I think very successful way. They're under construction. One's almost finished and they're turning out better than I hoped, which is really, really wonderful.
The rhythm of arches, a defining motif, continues with the warehouse windows and distinct fire shutters, echoing the craftsmanship of Brooklyn's enduring industrial character.
That's those old warehouse windows I was talking about with those fire shutters. And when you see them, you're kind of like, ah, yeah, you know, if you see that, you'll be like, yep, that's exactly what that is. And it's sort of a shorthand version of it. And it's very beautiful and strangely weird, but kind of works. Yeah, they're much more expressive than a standard boxy sort of window every 5 feet, 10 feet. Building. They somehow all work together. Took a lot of time. I have an amazing team, and just getting the windows to bunch together, the proportions, you know, working with the interior units, because there's no point doing a window if it doesn't work with the apartment inside. And so that coordination takes a lot of time, and you need people who are really talented to do that. So they really did an amazing job making it all work.
A range of amenities, including terraces, co-working spaces, a swimming pool, and a spa, are thoughtfully integrated within the building's tiered setbacks.
there's various setbacks required. And so terraces happen at certain parts of the building, and the zoning says, you know, like the, you know, the tower has to set, can only be 80% of the floor of the last, you know, below a certain height and so on and so forth. So you create these sort of setbacks, and the various things happen off them. So, you know, at the lower level, and there's many levels, right? If you look at the building, it's like three main levels. There's kind of one on top of the masonry part, and then there's one on top of like a wing of the tower, and then there's one actually on the tower itself. So all of those are accessed by the people in the building, and they are part of the outdoor landscaping that happens. And so off those, we have, where we can, incredible amenities for people. So, you know, I think on one of these towers, there's a swimming pool at one of the lower levels, a huge pool. And inside, adjacent to that, is an incredible spa. I mean, go figure. There's just this beautiful spa, and that has treatment rooms and everything else. And of course, it works with the pool. And then, you know, there's all sorts of other games rooms, lounges. Even though I was talking about how people are going back to work in New York City, not everybody is, and not everybody is every day of the week. In fact, I don't think many people are going back 5 days a week. I think the standard seems to be around 3 to 4 days a week, which means, you know, people are living in these apartments, and if they've got a partner or a roommate, they're kind of on top of each other. So these co-working spaces, so we're kind of creating office interiors in our buildings too, this kind of co-working space. And some people run their businesses out of there and do their podcasts. I think we might even have a podcast studio in this building. So you could definitely move in.
Within, the language of the arch reappears as vaulted lobby alcoves, where curvature and light lend spatial generosity to otherwise pragmatic thresholds.
Any apartment building is as good as the apartments in it, right? It sounds kind of obvious, but you'd be amazed at how, watch my French, how bad the layouts are of many of the projects that get built today. There's all sorts of codes we have to comply with, and there's all sorts of size requirements, and then there's a kind of efficiency of space. But, you know, these are people's homes, and they need to be deeply respected and thought about and given the time that they deserve. So even though we have a mixed range of apartments, 3 bedrooms, 2 bedrooms, 1 bedroom, studios, affordable units, matching that same distribution of unit type, we spend as much time on any of the apartments to make sure they work perfectly. And that is the key, right? If you start with that. And I've always believed that, you know, we do a lot of super high-end condos, and there the units are 5,000 square feet, you know, or 6,000 square feet. And here a 3-bedroom might be 1,200 square feet, you know. But it's actually harder to make a great unit when you've got less square feet. You have to work harder to make that work. So that's always been our philosophy about the plan and really spending time on that. And then we think about how you... One of the reasons why our buildings tend to be, we tend not to really do glassy residential buildings. I've always believed it's really nice to be able to look at a window and say, that's my apartment, you know, from outside. I think that's kind of something that makes you feel home. I think the great successful kind of apartment buildings of pre-war years always had these kind of more solid facades. And, you know, you could say, well, there's that little window at the back there that looks into the courtyard. That's my first apartment. So I think that's always important to us. I really don't like glassy apartment buildings where it's just a big curtain wall and it could be an office building. And then we think very much about how people use the building and how you arrive and enter the building as a lobby and that experience. And we try and think about how you... The standard for how you're going to think of the building starts at that front door, and how that experience takes you from there to the elevator, to the corridors, and then to your apartment door. And we think about, how does the door look? How do we put the number next to it? How do we do lighting next to the door? How do we make this special, right? How do you make it like you feel that all this money you're paying in rent for this tiny little apartment isn't the most stupid thing in the world and you need to move back to Oregon. It's like, how do we make you want to stay here? And so we spend a huge amount of time thinking about that. And that kind of from the front door to the front door of your apartment is really key. And then parallel to that is this sense of creating a community. When you've got 600 units, that's maybe 1,200 people living in there, if not more. And they're their own community and they're going to meet people. And so creating areas, games lounges, where you can, put aside, there's a TV, where you can watch the Super Bowl, have a Super Bowl party. I mean, very often people are having their birthday parties, they invite friends around, the apartment. I mean, I remember what it was like when I had my first apartment, still do, you couldn't invite 20 friends around, you could barely get yourself in. So these spaces where people can share them with their friends. And so a lot of thought about how it works and many different levels. And so we have an interiors team and they are second to none. They do absolutely beautiful work and they did an incredible job here. And they kind of, they take a theme and they run with it. So one building is all about nature and it's a palette of blues and greens and natural soft aquamarines. And it's all about how the canal's getting and the park is kind of renaturing the canal. And then the other one has a softer kind of russety kind of beige palette. And that's all about the old industrial kind of colors of rusted sort of metal and everything else. And they take that theme and they run them through not only through everything, through the corridors, the carpets, to the courts that they're using in the kitchens, but also to the amenities, to the gyms, to everything, that theme runs through everything. And so you create these buildings that are not only coherent outside, they're also very coherent inside. And because we're very lucky, we get to do all of it. Sometimes our clients will hire another firm to do the interiors. But we can really tie our language of the interiors and the architecture of the interiors to the architecture of the building as well.
Luckily, sustainability goals are heavily incentivized in New York City's building code, favoring electricity and pushing energy efficiency standards.
New York is, we're not on the West Coast, but our hearts are quite a lot of the time, I think, and so sustainability is very important here too. The city, again, came up with a really good strategy. It was like, if you build your building and it's 15% better than the energy code, will allow you to build 5% more floor area. So guess what? Everybody builds their buildings 15% greater than the energy code, which is just, and the energy code is really tough already, right? So you don't have to go, you can imagine like the energy code today is not the energy code of 15, 20 years ago. So by default or by incentive, New York is just really pushing the bar really, really high. So that incredibly complex energy models to make sure that we get there. And energy modeling itself is prerequisite in the zoning code too. So you can't just meet 15%, you have to have it energy modeled. And those energy models are making everything as efficient as it humanly can. So that's very clever. We also, the city's banned gas. So these are fully electric buildings with heat pumps. And I think we have gas for the emergency generator. And I think they still allow it for if we have retail kitchens, for restaurants on the ground floor. But no residents, no domestic hot water, no heating by gas. It's all electric. So we've been running at almost silver LEED standard, just as a base New York City code or zoning for a while. This has probably pushed it even higher. Strangely, I mean, because it's kind of forced on you, my clients aren't really interested in going for leads. It's weird because there's no real need for it. It's a goal that I remember listening to a person who set up leads, and he said, our success will be when we don't need leads. And if you're English, leads is something completely different. But and quite a few people in England might be upset if you got rid of leads because it's a nice city, but here, if you get rid of leads, that's because everybody else is doing better than you ever wanted in the first place. So I obviously a long way to go. It's not perfect. And leads keep improving their standards. So it's a moving target. We're not a passive house or anything like that on these buildings. But but we're getting closer and closer with every project we do.
Navigating value engineering discussions among all stakeholders often presents a significant design challenge.
Once you feel as though the building's got its heart and soul in the right place, I can kind of kick back. And I've got this wonderful group and teams of people who then take on all the responsibility of doing the incredible work of producing the drawings and dealing with everybody and trying to get this thing built and everything else. So I tend to not sleep at the beginning and then sleep really soundly for the next 2 or 3 years. So I think pushing it and making sure that we could, you know, we won this competition with a vision, making sure we could make sure that vision, we were able to follow through and can complete on it. I think one of the things that maybe the one thing that kept me up and during construction was value engineering. You know, it happens on every project. Our clients really wanted to build the building we designed. And at one point, we were going to, you know, the upper part of the building where it's got this lighter grid was meant to actually be precast. And they said, come and look at the precast mock-up. So I was like, it's in the office. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. How to get a precast mock-up in the office? So I went out to their office and there was this huge polystyrene stucco covered sort of thing that was there. What the contractor had said, look, use this instead and we can save $5-10 million. And I looked at it. And I felt like, I don't know if you remember the Star Trek, the early Star Trek shows where Kirk's, you know, hiding behind a polystyrene rock. And, you know, if he pushed it, the rock would, you'd see the rock moving as people came over, the aliens attacked him. But that's what it felt like. It felt like I was on a Star Trek set. And, you know, they'd signed a contract. They'd just gone ahead without telling us any of this, thinking that we wouldn't care, notice, or anything else. And so, you know, that's one of those sleepless moments where you have to help the client understand why that's not going to be a good thing. And we got there and we came up with alternate solutions. We went with metal, a kind of really detailed metal panel system that actually I think worked out much better. It's really beautiful. So it's kind of one of those, you know, often when you get these kind of big problems, they turn into good solutions that are better than you would have had if you hadn't had the problem. And this was one of those. But you always have to keep your guard up. So you never know when you're going to get caught out.
During construction, tariffs and supply chain delays pose challenges, as the curtain walls for the two towers were still in transit from Turkey.
One of the ones that was shocking, that was unexpected, is, you know, there's two towers, and they have curtain wall, and that curtain wall is being made, or window wall, and it's being made in Turkey. You know, one shipload of the curtain wall came, window wall came in, and then tariffs happened, and the next one stayed on the ship because no one knew what they were going to pay for it. So, you know, there's delays that happen that nowadays, some of them you could have forecast many years ago. Now you have no idea what's going to come at you. I think the client had to pay like an extra maybe $500,000 to get that stuff off the boat after having agreed and paid for it all in full in advance. So, you know, you can think what you like about tariffs, but that was an absolute tax on our client who's going to turn it into a tax, get to have to charge more rent if they can in order to pay it back, right? So that, but that's not really a construction thing that affected everything. I think, I actually, to be honest, I don't go to site very often because I get so upset about construction and what's happening, because it, you know, they're always, the GC always says, oh, well, your drawings didn't describe it properly, so we took the least obvious solution and went and built that. And you're just like, okay, I don't know how we solved that one. And I just got so sick of being lied to or being blamed for other people's problems that I now just really rely on these really good people that have much more patience and charm than I do to go and fix and make sure that we don't have these issues.
For Chris, cultivating strong client relationships is essential to delivering exceptional projects, particularly when scopes expand within tight budgets.
You know, these are amazing clients. I've worked with them for a long time. We're doing more projects with them. I wish all my clients were this good. I think one of the things that's happening as we get bigger and bigger commissions, even if I can't go look at my buildings, other people seem to like them. And so people want to hire us. And you're as good as your client. And we're having to learn that sometimes you have to turn projects away because of the client. And that, or because the end result is not something that you can be proud of and want to see. And our buildings last forever. So, well, ever-ish. And you really have to be, you know, you've got to think about the future and what you, your legacy and what you leave is. So I think that's the hardest thing we navigate is how do you do that? How do you create big architecture, very tight budgets? You know, we're not doing museums with massive or university buildings with massive endowments. We're doing very tight budget buildings and creating something that's really beautiful. So I think that's the lesson learned is find those good clients, hold on to them, try and keep them on your side. It's incredibly hard to navigate. And people get really upset if you say no as well. I mean, like, it's not like you can just say no. You have to be really thoughtful and clever about how you say no to potential clients. I mean, we say no to a lot of smaller projects, but even there, you know, they're like, who are you? And it's not, that's not a client-based thing. That's just a fee-based thing. But it's a nice problem to have. And then, you know, fast forward 2 years later and you're like, oh my gosh, I wish I'd said yes to everything. You just never know. But I do think you can get clients by maintaining standards. Like people understand how hard it is to do a good building on the budgets that we do them. I think that talks for itself. I think so when there are downtimes, our clients tend to be loyal, or we get clients from elsewhere or coming and using us because they see our work. So I think it has benefits. You know, I think that race to the bottom ultimately does you no favors in trying to get work either.
In its material expression, spatial hierarchy, and environmental intelligence, Nevin's Landing exemplifies the next chapter of waterfront architecture in New York, one that honors industrial memory while advancing a collective, sustainable future for the city's built environment. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Chris thought are the biggest differences between the UK and the US when it comes to architecture. And who's doing a better job of it?
I write this quarterly column for a newspaper, architect newspaper back in the UK. And it's meant to be a letter from America explaining how we do things differently here than in the UK. And, you know, I'd say on a general level, most of the stuff that happens in the UK is done better, mainly because they have a much more rigorous set of planning constraints on people, on design and everything else. And that gives you a very kind of good standard level of architecture with occasional brilliant pieces of architecture. But it also can be fairly domestic and small scale. I think what the US does is it has much more freedom for architects to explore and do things. And so you get things that happen here that you wouldn't see in the UK. I mean, like the Chrysler Building would never happen in London, right? That exuberance of American forward thinking, or, you know, all the way through to like the Jenga Building by Herzog de Meuron again. You know, that is a unique building. It's kind of, it only happens in New York because that's where anybody can go that high and try and explore that language and do it so well. So I think that's where America kind of does better. But I'd say on that scale, I'm the UK and Europe generally is much more respectful of its urban environment than the US.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Chris. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I sort of love cities. You know, they're deeply important to everyone and to me especially. They're like these containers full of amazing buildings that you as an architect can go look at and get inspired by. So, you know, I think my goal is to leave whatever city we're working in a slightly better state than it was before we arrived. If we can do that with architecture, that's my goal. Yeah, I think that's it. They, like I said, they last forever. So, you know, they deserve some thought and time and energy to make sure that they hold up as well as they can.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple